Today on Vox Talks Economics, how does trade policy affect competition? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Center for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics, so remember to subscribe. And if you like what you're hearing, give us a review too, preferably one with 5 stars. How does a bilateral trade agreement affect the markup that firms charge? We got good evidence that domestic firms reduce their markups. What do exporters do and why? And why is this significant? Well, I've come to the University of Cambridge to meet Meredith Crowley, who's one of the authors of a new discussion paper that questions and updates some of the models that trade economists have been using. Meredith, welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Thanks, Tim. I'm glad to be here.
This is a complicated story, but you are the person to make sense of it. This goes back to some of the work that Paul Krugman was doing 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah. So our paper builds on what's known as the new trade theory that was initiated by Paul Krugman, 1979, 1980. And his contribution was to build a model of trade around firms competing. And this was very different from what we'd had previously with the sort of David Ricardo comparative advantage. Mm-hmm. And Paul Krugman was really interested in the consumer and how demand for goods could pull trade flows and what this meant for competition among firms. Mm-hmm. But we made some progress with Krugman's work, but the huge innovation came in the early 2000s when Mark Mellitz introduced what's known as the Mellitz effect. And so Mark took Paul's work and introduced the idea that the firms competing domestically in economy, as well as foreign firms that would be producing and maybe thinking about exporting, had productivity that varied. So some firms in the economy would have very, very high productivity and efficiency, and others making a very similar product or the same product would have low productivity. And so what you had in any big economy was some super efficient firms that produced very large quantities, employed lots of people, and because of the way the model was structured, they set reasonably high markups. But there would be a distribution of firms. So alongside these super efficient firms, we had other firms that were really just producing small quantities and staying in the market by the skin of their teeth. So they had markups just barely covering their costs. And in that world, what Mark showed was if the economy opened to trade, you could have a huge increase in the economy's aggregate productivity because what competition from foreigners would do is it would push out the weakest firms in the economy. So the guys who are really just marginal, this competitive fringe, they would go bankrupt and they would close. And what that meant was the remaining firms operating the economy would expand. They'd hire that freed up labor. They'd make more stuff. And because they were already more efficient, the aggregate efficiency of the economy would rise. And so this was a very important observation that was very difficult for trade economists to explain when we first observed it, when we saw a wave of trade liberalizations in the 80s and 90s that had much bigger productivity increases than we could really understand, given the existing kind of models we'd been using.
Intuitively, that makes sense from what we can see. And it also put a lot of impetus behind making these tariff-reducing trade agreements.
Absolutely. And after the initial work Mark did, we had further work. He has some empirical work with Dan Preffler looking at the Canadian trade liberalization. Mm-hmm. And we saw a lot of real improvements in firm productivity. The empirical literature around this by trade economists was heavily focused on how can we evaluate and assess productivity of firms in a domestic economy? And there was a lot of innovation in terms of empirical approaches to understanding how to estimate productivity and get some sense of how this was changing over time.
Because this ties the trade literature to the sort of research that's being done in the efficiency of domestic firms, the productivity of domestic firms.
Absolutely. So this is building off of an important IO literature looking at productivity. And of course, we're today in the UK. Productivity is hugely important. The UK has been in a productivity slowdown for years, and this is a real puzzle and something that economists would like to boost. So understanding that's very important.
So end of story. We've resolved everything.
I wish. But our story today in this paper goes in a different direction.
Yeah.
So after this initial research by Mellitz, there's been a huge literature following studying trade, studying productivity. where our paper takes off from is a different vein of the research, which was initiated by Atkison and Burstein in a paper in the American Economic Review in 2008. And they, as macroeconomists, were interested in a different side of trade liberalizations. They were really interested in pricing. Mm-hmm. And how could we understand the prices that firms were charging? And so while trade has been concerned with real consumer welfare, the quantity of things that people consume, productivity of firms, macro has always had more interest in pricing and pricing behavior. And so this Atkison and Burstein model, one of the things they were interested in was understanding a whole bunch of strange observations on pricing and international pricing and, you know, very basic things. We know that a firm selling a product in two different markets will often charge different prices.
Yeah.
And so that we call pricing to market. We think that a firm that has a bigger market share in one market would set a higher price because they have more pricing power. Mm-hmm. So if I'm a big guy, I have a big share of the Canadian market as an exporter, I might actually use my big market share and not very much competition from other Canadians, other firms in the market, to set a pretty high price when I sell to Canada. But at the same time, if I'm also selling to the US, a much bigger, deeper competitive market, my market share might be smaller because there's a lot of other people selling in the US, mm-hmm. and I might not have such power, so I set a lower price. This pricing to market is a sort of departure point for Atkison and Burstein. And one of the things they did in their approach was they started with a framework similar to Mellett's, but they built into it a demand structure that had some features of monopolistic competition, which is the framework introduced by Paul Krugman into trade and followed on in the work of Mellett's. They started with that framework, but they used a particular form so that the firm's market share in the domestic market actually conferred upon it more pricing power. Mm-hmm. This is a little bit of a technical point, but we think a firm faces an elasticity of demand. If demand is very inelastic, so you're selling something that there's not a good substitute for, consumers really want your good, you have more power in that if you raise the price, not many consumers will fall off. On the other hand, if you have a very elastic demand, there's lots of other substitutes for your good. Mm-hmm. And if you sell in a market, if you try to raise your price, you'll lose a lot of consumers. And so they built into this monopolistic competition framework an idea that a firm's market share in a particular market would confer upon it less elastic demand. This meant that they could charge higher prices. Mm-hmm. So what we did in our paper was we were very interested in using a framework like Atkison and Burstein, and we sat down with 25 million observations on the prices and the quantities sold by firms from 11 low and middle income countries to 165 destinations around the world. We wanted to understand how do firms from low and middle income countries change their prices mm-hmm. in various markets around the world when they sign a trade agreement or when the tariff they face in that market has been reduced.
So a typical country would be what, for example?
So the three biggest economies in our data set are China, Egypt, and Mexico.
Okay, let's say Egypt. The firms exporting from Egypt, there is a trade agreement which reduces tariffs, and those firms can now export to,
say, the European Union.
The European Union, lower tariffs.
Yes. Yeah, so what we were observing in our data was when these tariffs were coming down, we would have expected, very standard thing, for the Egyptian firms' market share in the European Union to go up.
Yes.
So basically, you give Egypt a preference in the EU. That means this Egyptian firm is going to take a little market share either from maybe domestic EU producers mm-hmm. or from third countries. So say there were exports coming in from Morocco, they might steal some of that market share away from the Moroccan firms.
Yes.
We observed that. So in the data, we could see the market share of the Egyptian firms in the EU going up. But then we observed at the same time that these same firms were cutting their average markup. The price premium that they were getting in the EU, the market that had just cut the tariff, it was actually going down. And this contradicted a standard prediction we would get from the Atkison Burstein model, because in their model, if your market share goes up, your demand becomes less elastic. This is a measure of how much market power you have, and we would expect you to raise your markup. And so we were left with this puzzle of what's going on exactly. How can a firm that's getting a market share growing be forced into reducing its markup?
When you started on your empirical work, were you expecting it to confirm the previous model and you were surprised with what showed up?
Yeah, we were. We were expecting to estimate a model of Atkinson-Burstein on low and middle income countries, maybe get different parameter estimates. Their original model had focused on two countries. We were doing a multi-country world. And so we thought there might be some interesting new twists and turns, but we were surprised and puzzled.
You weren't expecting it to go in completely the other direction.
This has been a challenging few years for trade policymakers. Subscribe to Vox Talks and you will find many episodes in which we discuss the problems and the solutions. For example, the episode Is Europe's Trade Strategy Fit for Purpose from February 2021, or from April the same year, The Problem of Digital Trade.
Okay, how did you make sense of this then, Meredith?
I guess the simple version is we then went and we looked at, well, what's going on in our framework empirically, like what's happening with the number of firms? And what we could see was when a country like Egypt faced a cut in the tariff, we didn't have the same number of firms exporting to the EU before and after the trade liberalization. What we saw was entry of new Egyptian firms from Egypt into the EU market.
Ah.
And so the thing is, if we went all the way back to a Mellitz world, introducing just sort of one small guy at the competitive fringe, they wouldn't really be very important because they wouldn't sell a whole lot.
No.
And because of the assumed structure of the market, their marginal didn't do much. But the interesting thing was once we had entry by firms from Egypt into the EU and we had an Atkinson-Burstein framework, on average, we were looking at before trade liberalization, the median number of firms in our developing country sample exporting to any country in our world was about two.
Mm-hmm.
We were suddenly moving from two to three. And this is a very different market structure. So with three Egyptian exporters of, say, t-shirts into the EU, they're all charging a bit of a big markup because relative to each other, they've got a lot of market power. You introduce an extra firm, like a fourth one, and this is really putting more competition among themselves. So the difference is we looked at a new way of thinking about demand in which we started with Atkinson-Burstein's world. We said a market share and a destination should be important, but we said it's not just how big this firm is compared to all the other makers of, say, t-shirts in the EU, but it's really that the Egyptian firms maybe are most concerned and most substitutable with other peer firms from their country. A firm exporting from Egypt to the EU is maybe first level most concerned by its peers selling the same product.
Mm-hmm.
The next level, they're thinking about, well, what would firms from other countries that make t-shirts be doing? And then they are still aware of their overall role in the market. But the key insight we got was actually this peer-to-peer competition among firms from the same origin was really important, and that empirically, it looks like you compete more intensely with firms from your own origin country than you do with firms already in the market you're selling to. So European firms, as well as, say, other country exporters. So Egypt might be particularly concerned with firms from Turkey selling in EU.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of market structure, we're going almost back in time to a kind of 1980s IO version of the world, which is among these manufacturing firms in low and middle income countries, when they're exporting and there's only two or three of them in a market, they actually have quite a bit of market power relative to each other. When you have a trade liberalization, and this means that additional firms from their own country enter the market, that level of competition can have a big depressive effect on their markups. And so this is really beneficial for the home country in the sense that it's pushing prices down. There's like an extra kick beyond the initial productivity benefits that Mellitz's work had shown us.
But it is hugely consequential, isn't it, for those low middle income countries and the way in which their economies develop?
I think it should be that this liberalization is creating, rather than the, say, Egyptian firm that may be large. So I guess what we're showing is they're too being subject to this competitive force. And we're also observing that in many cases, people think about low and middle income countries as having very few firms operating in the international market, that one of the things we're seeing is more firms in these low and middle income countries being drawn into the international market, and that having real downward pressure on prices, it's beneficial.
So should this influence the way in which we consider the welfare benefits of these bilateral trade agreements? Do we have to start to rethink them?
So nowadays, when governments do an assessment of how beneficial will a trade agreement be, they're really concerned with the impact on wages and the overall structure of the economy. So we know that some industries will atrophy, others will expand. Mm-hmm. And that's really been the focus. And there are gains from trade, but our study shows that there's this extra kick if your trade liberalization stimulates more entry into your market. And there are two recent implications that I think we could think about. So one is when Donald Trump imposed tariffs on China, we as economists were somewhat surprised. So what we observed in sort of two influential papers, one published in the Journal of Economic Perspectives, another one in the Quarterly Journal of Economics, studying what's the impact of tariff increases on prices paid by Americans. Both of these studies found actually almost all of the tariff increase passed directly into prices Americans paid. So if there was a 10% tariff, the price Americans paid went up basically 10%. And lots of people said, okay, that's obvious. But for trade economists, we were quite surprised because what we had expected to happen was we had thought, oh, well, these Chinese firms will want to keep their hold on the U.S. market. And so we had expected many of them would lower their prices at the dock. So we had thought, oh, the Chinese firm's going to cut the price they charge at the dock by, you know, down 5%. So maybe the price Americans pay would only go up 5%. And what we found was this kind of very puzzling thing that Chinese firms weren't lowering their price at all. Well, our paper might have something to say on that because one of the things we do know is that there were fewer exports from China to the U.S. So if what we had was the competitive fringe guys, the ones with sort of lower productivity, if the number of firms exporting from China to the U.S. fell, it might have meant that the ones that stayed in the market had more market power. And so although there was a tariff, they weren't forced to lower their price because actually as the tariff came on, if you force some Chinese firms out of the market, that means the ones that survive face less competition amongst one themselves. Mm-hmm. And that would be one explanation for why we saw prices not falling. And similarly, today we face high inflation in Britain. And one of the things we observe since the introduction of our new trading arrangement with the EU called the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, we know that there's much lower levels of trade coming into the UK. So while the UK's exports to the EU have held up reasonably well, we had a big decline in EU exports to the UK at the start. And so one of the concerns is that if the additional paperwork and sort of slowness at the border has forced the sort of smallest European producers to say, you know what, it's just not worth the extra hassle to export to Britain, we might be in a situation where there are fewer European firms exporting the same goods. That would increase their market power and could be something that could be contributing to higher prices in Britain. So there's many, many factors going on with prices today. The war in Ukraine, the oil shock, gas shock is like a leading factor. But at the same time, Brexit was a huge change for the UK economy. And one of our concerns should be, has this dissuaded foreign exporters from the EU into selling to Britain? And if so, does this mean the remaining firms have more market power and can kind of squeeze more gains out of British consumers?
Whenever I talk to trade economists, there is always a surprising result to explain. This work is never finished, but it's particularly relevant now as we are seeing some of the retreat from globalization, the effects of Brexit. There's going to be a lot more to explain about this, isn't there, Meredith?
Yeah, I think so. I think one of the other interesting things to me about this project is, I said at one point, this uses data we got largely from the World Bank. It was provided to us very generously. The national governments had shared this data with the World Bank. And so we have, you know, over 500,000 firms from around the world, and we have 25 million individual year product firm observations. And so whereas the earlier research studying productivity had looked at sort of purely domestic data. So they would have, at the time, super exciting work looking at every firm in the economy and their productivity and how productivity changed. Now we're in a world where we have a huge amount of data on prices firms are charging over long periods of time. And we can develop new empirical methodologies for understanding price differences across markets that don't require detailed data on every single input the firm had. So logically, we're using panel data econometrics methods. And with this approach, because a firm from China is selling the same product, like men's cotton t-shirts, in the European Union, in the United States, in Canada, so at least three markets, we can look at the differences in the prices they charge in these different markets over time. One of these markets gives them a tariff cut. This allows us to see the before and after, and we can use sort of the power of big data to answer new questions and kind of resolve older puzzles we had in the literature about why are prices in some markets higher than in others.
There's plenty more work to do on this project then.
Yeah. No, I think we're just at the beginning. It's really exciting stuff.
Good luck with it, Meredith. Thank you for talking about it today.
Thanks very much for having me.
The paper is called The Pro-Competitive Effects of Trade Agreements. The authors are Meredith Crowley, Lou Han, and Thomas Preyer. It is discussion paper 17463 at CPR, probably the first of many.
Next time on Vox Talks Economics, how modern empires rise and how they fall.